All right, are there any other matters we need to take up before we go back on record?
No, ma'am.
Not from the government?
Thank you.
All right. We're back on the record then in the case of Snyder versus Secretary HHS, and I see Dr. Ward advancing toward the witness chair, so Caroline, who's your next witness?
No need for respondent to do it.
All right. Would you raise your right hand, Dr. Ward? Do you swear or affirm that the evidence you shall give in the case now in hearing should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God?
I do.
Go ahead. Should say, so help you God. All right. You may proceed, Ms. Babcock.
Dr. Ward, could you please state and spell your name for the record?
Brian Ward, W-A-R-D.
And Brian with an I?
B-R-I-A-N, yes.
Okay. And you testified during the Cedillo trial, correct?
I did.
And so we're not going to go through an extensive re-discussion of your qualifications, but could you just tell the court where you're currently employed?
I'm currently at McGill University in the Divisions of Infectious Diseases and Microbiology.
And have you also published and studied the measles virus?
I have.
Including book chapters, articles?
Yes.
And have you also seen patients with the measles virus infections?
Yes, many.
But how many do you estimate over the course of your medical career?
I haven't kept notches on my belt, but probably many hundreds, perhaps low thousands.
Okay. What materials did you review in preparation for your testimony today?
I reviewed the medical records that were sent to me, the expert opinions that were sent to me, and I resorted to the medical literature when necessary.
And you've, of course, also reviewed the medical records and materials in Cedillo?
Yes.
And I should say, as Mr. Powers did earlier, do you incorporate your opinion in Cedillo by reference in this testimony as
yes,
well?
Yes, of course.
Okay. And therefore, we're going to attempt not to replicate that testimony again. But here, in this case, again, there's been some effort to use SSPE and MIBE as models for Colton Snyder. I even think at one point in Colton's medical records, they were working him up for SSPE. What is the clinical picture of someone with SSPE?
As Dr. Rima said, the most common clinical picture is a period of confusing clinical presentation, typically at least 5 to 7 years after wild-type measles, and often the diagnosis is not immediately entertained, but after a period of progressive clinical deterioration, then somebody thinks of the diagnosis and the diagnosis is made. So far the individuals with SSPE progress inexorably to death.
And is there inflammation in the brains of people with SSPE?
Well, there's surprisingly little inflammation. That's one of the things that people don't really understand why there is so little inflammation in the brains of these individuals, but it's not extensive inflammation that you would see from an acute viral encephalitis or bacterial meningitis, for example.
Now, ADEM or PIEM, can they be associated with measles virus?
Yes, they are also reported to occur after wild-type measles virus. And may very rarely occur following vaccine exposures.
Is Colton Snyder's clinical picture consistent with ADEM?
Not at all.
Now, Dr. Kingsborn discussed a 2004 editorial by Paul Dykin discussing a condition called MINE, which I believe is measles-induced neuroautistic encephalopathy. It's a paper that was actually introduced in the last day of the Cedillo trial, actually during Diane Griffin's cross, if I recall. And hadn't been previously referenced by any of the experts. Do you think this theory, as offered in the editorial by Dr. Dykin, is scientifically sound?
No. It's quite an amusing acronym because it is sort of laying claim to an acronym that seems quite possessive.
It's mine.
But in this particular instance, it seems that Dr. Dykin simply took articles that were in the literature in a completely non-critical way and said, well, if this is true and this is true and this is true, then there might be this new thing that I'm going to call mine. And it was only subsequent to that publication, which was in a fairly obscure medical journal, that many of the problems with the hypothesis became apparent, and Dr. Dakin hasn't said anything else about this since then.
And sort of following up on that, to your knowledge, was this editorial written before information came out in the UK MMR litigation that caused the funding to be withdrawn?
Yes, it was. I'm not sure, I don't recall when it was submitted, but it was certainly published prior to the suspension of the UK litigation.
Now, switching topics, is IVIG a treatment commonly used for wild measles virus infection?
Almost never, except in the very unusual circumstance of a baby, a newborn baby, who's exposed to a mother who develops measles, either in the last few days of pregnancy or in the first weeks to months after delivery of the child. And the reason that it's used in those circumstances is because the maternal antibody generally protects the child during the first 4 to 8 months of life. And if the mother develops acute measles, then she obviously could not have transmitted any of those protective antibodies to her child. Also, the mother is in close contact with the baby, and so there is a virtual certainty of transmission to the child. In that case, IVIG is occasionally used to give the baby a better chance, because the mortality from natural disease is very, very high in very young infants.
So when it's used there, does IVIG contain measles neutralizing antibodies?
Yeah, yes, it does. The in North America, and I think also in Europe, but certainly for North America, the FDA requires that IVIG formulations in different lots have a minimal amount of antibodies directed against common childhood exanthems.
Do these levels fluctuate depending on the batch or source of the IVIG?
Oh, absolutely. That's why the FDA made that requirement of minimal amounts, because people were using these products assuming that they all had lots of measles or varicella or other antibodies. And when it was discovered that, in fact, they didn't, in some cases, some lots had very low measles antibodies, the FDA required that there be a certain minimal level, but there's wide variability above that minimal level, so that some lots have much more anti-measles antibodies than other lots.
So because of that, if you were using IVIG to treat a purportedly persistent measles virus infection, would it be important to take titer levels before you administer the IVIG?
Sure. Well, if you've got a choice of lots, it would be, I would think, a very reasonable precaution to take to use the lot that had the highest titers and make sure that you had enough of it to treat the individual for a period of time. You'd basically buy as much of it as you thought you would need.
Now, is IVIG ever used to treat MIBE?
No, because most people don't believe that that's active measles. Oh, measles inclusion body encephalitis, yes, sorry. Yes, rarely. In the case of an individual with MIBE, they might actually use it as a temporizing measure to see if they could actually protect the individual for a long enough period of time for their immune systems to come back.
And even with the use of IVIG, what is the usual course for someone with MIBE?
Well, most individuals with MIBE will die, and IVIG can temporize for a while, and if the immunosuppression that allowed them to be susceptible to that manifestation cannot be reversed, then even in the presence of IVIG, the most likely outcome is that they will probably die as well.
Is there evidence that wild-type measles virus actually cures some autoimmune diseases?
Yes, it's one of the sort of interesting little things about measles is that there's a limited but quite consistent literature of children who have well-defined autoimmune conditions prior to the development of wild-type measles, and then after wild-type measles, the disease is either suppressed for a long period of time or goes away. They're permanently cured.
Now, in his original opinions, and I realize he's been put forth as the treating doctor, not as an official expert, but certainly he wrote several expert opinions, Dr. Bradstreet cites to Dr. Singh several papers by Dr. Singh, and we certainly know that Dr. Singh did some testing on Colton Snyder here. Are the tests that Dr. Singh did on Colton Snyder consistent with what you understand petitioner's theory to be in this case?
Well, I've said many times that I'm often not really sure what the petitioner's theories are. There seem to be many of them in Dr. Bradstreet's written statements. But if the simplified position is that you have a persisting measles virus infection that somehow causes autistic spectrum disorder, then I don't see any support for this hypothesis in Dr. Singh's work or in Dr. Bradstreet's arguments.
Did Dr. Singh test Colton's CSF for measles virus antibodies?
Yes, he did.
And what were the results?
That result was negative.
Now, Dr. Bradstreet's explanation for the negative test is that Colton received IVIG treatment not long before the sample was drawn. Is this explanation persuasive to you?
Well, not at all, because the half-life of antibodies is typically stated to be 4 weeks, and certainly if they're made by the individual. And so it would have to be, if you are making antibodies, you wouldn't expect them just to disappear. The mother gives the child IgG just prior to delivery, and those antibodies last typically 8 to 9 months. And so if Colton had antibodies in his brain, in his CSF rather, one wouldn't expect them simply to turn on or off like a switch with IVIG administration.
Now, Dr. Kingsborn cited to work by Dr. Pardo, particularly on page 17 of his report. And in the middle there was, he discusses it as evidence that some scientists may believe that environmental toxins or infections in the presence of genetic susceptibility can lead to neuroinflammation and autism. Is Dr. Pardo's laboratory actively studying potential environmental causes of autism?
Yes.
And are Dr. Pardo or his colleague, I believe Dr. Suedo, considering the MMR vaccine or measles virus in their research?
No, they're not. They're not testing for measles virus.
Now, is a theory being proposed here that measles virus persists in the human and eventually results in autism, consistent with any condition associated with wild or vaccine strain measles virus?
Sorry, could you repeat that question?
The theory being proposed here that measles virus persists in the system and eventually results in autism, consistent with any condition associated with wild or vaccine strain measles?
Not that I'm aware of. To my knowledge, there's no convincing evidence whatsoever that exposure to wild-type measles is associated with autism at all. Given the number of children who experience wild-type measles in the world still, 500,000 cases, and certainly it's assumed that virtually everybody in the world prior to the introduction of the vaccine experienced wild-type disease, the silence in the medical literature on any association between wild-type measles and autism is striking. It's not an association that would have been missed, because wild-type measles came in waves. And normally, for example, the east coast of the U.S. had an outbreak of measles with thousands of cases in the 1990s. The eastern provinces of Canada had a similar outbreak at that time. Many children were infected with measles in a relatively short period of time, and there wasn't a sudden burst in autism in either the Canada or the States following following those very well-defined outbreaks of measles in societies that certainly have the tools to do surveillance for things like autism.
Now, moving on to the unigenetics testing. And again, you testified about a lot of this in Sedillo. We're not going to duplicate that here. But talking about Colton Snyder specifically, I believe that even petitioner's experts concede that at best Colton Snyder's gut biopsy is borderline positive, or I think Dr. Kennedy actually stated he wouldn't have confidence that measles virus is actually in Colton's gut. Do you agree?
I think with what Dr. Lima just explained to the court, it's impossible to have confidence in either of those results because it's entirely plausible that the very high titers that one saw in the that were reported in the CSF were simply the result of very, very low copy numbers that were then multiplied enormously by a very low GAPDH copy number value. So I would say that if Dr. Kennedy has difficulty believing the gut results, I would hope that after the testimony of Dr. Rima, he has a similar level of concerns about the CSF reported values.
Now, Dr. Rima talked about this morning, that with the positive, markedly positive, or reportedly very highly positive CSF and negative whole blood results, there might be a logical inconsistency there. Do you agree?
Well, sure. Measles is essentially a completely cell-associated virus. There's very little evidence of virus living outside of the cells. Obviously, it has to move from cell to cell at some point, but it does that with enormous efficiency, almost frightening efficiency. And so a virus that's released by a cell breaking would enter into another cell essentially instantaneously. And so when people have looked to isolate virus from, for example, blood, you can't isolate the virus from the plasma. You can only isolate the virus from the cells. In an individual with some degree of neuroinflammation, or even without any inflammation, the only cells that are floating around in the cerebrospinal fluid are the lymphoid cells, the white blood cells. And yes, those are the same white blood cells that are in the blood. So if you have extremely high copy numbers in the white blood cells in the brain, it is completely logically inconsistent that you would not see those the same virus in the white blood cells in the peripheral circulation.
Now, is it accurate to say that PCR can be used both as a diagnostic tool and a research tool?
Sure.
What was Unigenetics using its testing for in this circumstance?
Well, I think quite clearly they were using it as a diagnostic tool. They were reporting results that were specific to an individual child.
When you're using something as a diagnostic tool, what's an acceptable rate of false positives?
Well, I could turn that question around to the court, but really, if it's me being diagnosed with a serious condition, I'd like it to be as close to 100% sensitive and specific as possible. Very few tests actually achieve that rate of sensitivity and specificity, but all competent labs strive to make their tests that sensitive and that specific. And some of them come remarkably close. Imagine if a test gave out 10% false positive results. On the one hand, you'd say, well, gosh, they got it right 90% of the time. But on the other hand, if that test is HIV and it's you, that's a completely unacceptable rate of false positives because 1 in 10 individuals would be falsely informed that they had HIV, for example.
Have you recently had occasion to speak with Michael Oldstone about Unigenetics?
I did with some fear and trepidation, in fact, because as a graduate student and a postdoctoral fellow working in Diane Griffin's lab, I had occasion to witness Michael Oldstone taking apart a fellow trainee in a session in Philadelphia, in fact. And I came out of the session and asked in a loud whisper, is Michael Oldstone always such a blank? Deleted for the purposes of the transcript, and it turned out, you know, my friend went like this, and he was standing right behind the door. So he has quite a reputation for remembering things like that and taking people's heads off. So I was I was a little hesitant to call him, but I decided to call him and ask because I thought he might be interested in knowing the extent to which some of the experts for the in the Snyder case were using his work to support their hypothesis.
And as I believe has been noted, it was also used quite extensively in Cedillo, correct?
And it was used extensively in Cedillo. So I plucked up my courage and I was, well, both reassured and a little humbled by the fact that, of course, I'd completely forgotten who I was. And so my comment out of the meeting was, I guess, not very memorable for him. It was memorable for me. But I asked him if he was aware of how his data was being used, and I thought misinterpreted, and then he told me about his interaction with Dr. O'Leary and Wakefield in the early 2000s.
Who funded this I guess you should, maybe if you can explain what exactly happened.
Well, I only know what Dr. Wakefield told me over the phone, which
Dr. Oldstone?
Sorry, Dr.
You said Dr. Wakefield.
Oh, right. Dr. Oldstone. It's Dr. Oldstone. I only know what he told me over the phone. I took notes during the meeting, during the telephone conversation. And essentially, he was approached by a politician, a California politician, Mr. Rollins, I believe, who was associated with the Mind Institute. And at the behest of Andrew Wakefield, they wanted to encourage Dr. Oldstone to work with Drs. O'Leary and Wakefield to assess the hypothesis of the persistence of measles virus in individuals with autistic spectrum disorder.
So was this testing funded by the Mind Institute?
Yes. What Dr. Oldstone said was, probably what all researchers say, is if you want me to do something, can you fund me to do this? And what he asked specifically was for funding for a postdoctoral fellow to work in his lab for a period of time to prepare samples and send them to Dr. O'Leary's laboratory in a coded, blinded fashion.
And what were the results of this exercise?
Again, according to Dr. Oldstone, a number of samples were prepared from different tissues and also different in vitro infected cell lines, so that uninfected cell lines and uninfected tissues, the tissues that were used here were from Michael Oldstone's transgenic mouse model, where he put the gene for one of the receptors for the virus into a mouse, and so he could infect some tissues in the mouse. And so he was able to send, for example, some gut tissues and brain tissue, but he used a measles virus to infect some of the mouse tissues and some of the in vitro cell cultures at different levels of infection, and these blinded samples were sent to Dr. O'Leary's lab, and then both Dr. O'Leary and Dr. Oldstone together unblinded the set of specimens to find out how well the O'Leary lab had done.
And how well had they done?
About 80% accuracy. About 80% of the samples were correctly identified as being either positive or negative, but about 10% were found to be false positive, so there was no virus present, but the O'Leary lab reported that there was, and others which had no virus, which had virus, in some cases high titer virus, were reported as negative. So they were both. And Dr. Oldstone's recollection was that it was 50-50. About half of the incorrectly classified samples were false positive and the other half were false negative.
Now, as a scientist and someone who performs PCR, is this an acceptable rate of, is the 20% acceptable in doing testing for the purposes Unigenetics was doing it?
Well, it's not even acceptable in a research lab. If one had an assay that was giving you both false positives and false negatives, you'd fix the assay, as opposed to continuing to do research with it, because you're going to have a guaranteed 20% inaccuracy in whatever you're doing. And it's wildly inappropriate for a diagnostic lab. That any lab, let me rephrase it. If the only test available to you is this test, then under certain circumstances you could justify doing that test, but the results of that test that were only 80% accurate would have to be sent out with a big red warning saying, be aware that this test is wrong 20% of the time. And then the clinicians can make a decision based on what they're getting and based on the reliability of the assay. Of course, that was never done by the O'Leary lab.
Did Dr. Oldstone try to publish the results?
Well, actually, the story wasn't finished because after the first round of testing, Dr. Oldstone and Dr. O'Leary neither of them was happy.
Understand.
And so according to Dr. Oldstone, there was an agreement, again, between the two of them, that they should do it again. That Dr. O'Leary was going to try to make the assays work better. And so another set of samples was prepared by the postdoctoral fellow. Again, they were sent to Dr. O'Leary's laboratory. And again, the results were jointly unblinded by Drs. O'Leary and Dr. Oldstone. And once again, the samples were found to be only about 80% accurately diagnosed. And again, there was about 50-50 false positive and false negative. If this wasn't troubling enough, Dr. Oldstone did something that was, I think, quite careful. He took some of the samples that had been called false positive or false negative in the first go-around were the same identical samples. These were not new samples, but the same identical samples were given new code numbers and sent back. So the same identical samples were sent back, and in several instances, samples that had been false positive now became false negative, and others that had been false negative now became false positive. And at that point, Dr. Oldstone said that he was no longer interested in collaborating and suggested that the results should be published.
And was Dr. Oldstone successful in that effort?
He was not. He made a fundamental error, I think, of trust in not having a pre-granting agreement, which is fairly standard, actually, where the investigator has the right to publish the results even if the sponsor doesn't like them. He did not have that agreement with the MIND Institute, and he was unable to publish these results.
Is it fair to say that officials, Dr. O'Leary and people in his camp, were unhappy with the results?
I'm not sure how anyone could possibly be happy with the results.
Now, in his testimony on Tuesday, Dr. Kennedy suggested that some of the problems might have actually been because of contamination in Dr. Oldstone's lab. What's your reaction?
I'm sure Dr. Oldstone has had contamination in his lab. As Dr. Rima said, we all have. Anybody who works with PCR has to deal with contamination. It happens all the time. The quality of the lab is not in whether you have contamination or not, but it's how you respond to that contamination. If you respond by ignoring negative controls that go positive, that is not a responsible reaction. If you try to figure out where the contamination is coming from and fix it, then of course. So it's entirely possible that there may have been some contamination in Dr. Oldstone's laboratory at some point, but he is one of the, I think, most meticulous scientists I know of, because I don't really even know him, and has a track record of more than 50 years of high-quality, high-impact publication in this area using a huge variety of technologies, including PCR. So if there was a contamination in Dr. Oldstone's laboratory, I would think, very close to complete confidence that he would do whatever he could to fix it.
And given the purpose of the exercise, which is in fact to see if Dr. O'Leary could properly identify positive and negative samples. Do you think Dr. Oldstone would have taken extra care to ensure that what he was sending was in fact what he thought he was sending?
Absolutely. It's also, I think, quite relevant that the issue of contamination in Dr. Oldstone's laboratory did not come up in the conversation between Dr. O'Leary and Dr. Oldstone between the first and the second round of testing. It was only when the O'Leary lab failed to achieve a reasonable rate of sensitivity and specificity that any concerns were raised about Dr. Oldstone's competence to prepare samples and send them to Dr. O'Leary's laboratory.
Now, Dr. Kennedy also suggested on Tuesday that one of the reasons Dr. O'Leary might have missed some of the positive tests from Dr. Oldstone's lab is because the copy numbers were very low. It was low detectable limits. Does that agree? Does that make sense given what actually happened in the attempt to replicate?
Sure. I think to be a good test, and my daughter is now trying to get into high schools, and I keep telling her, to be a good test, it has to be hard. And so I'm sure that Dr. Oldstone sent Dr. O'Leary some slam-dunk easy samples and some really low copy number samples. I think Dr. Rima pointed out very clearly that a large number of labs around the world would have beaten a path to his door had he really been able to do this in order to initiate collaborations with Dr. O'Leary, because he was claiming to do something that nobody had actually done yet. And so I'm sure that it's plausible that some of the low positive samples that Dr. Oldstone sent to Dr. O'Leary's lab might be missed because of lack of sensitivity. However, that doesn't explain how a test can be false positive. That's not an issue of sensitivity, that's an issue of specificity. And it certainly doesn't explain how a false positive can become false negative or a false negative can become false positive. Those are just, it's impossible that that would occur because low copy number was there.
Now, did Dr. Oldstone also discuss or comment on the hypothesized link between MMR and ASD?
Yes, he said that he was quite willing to believe that there could be such an association when he entered into this agreement with Dr. O'Leary with funding from the Mind Institute. Dr. Oldstone is a curmudgeon. He's a tough old guy, and there's no way that he would waste his time setting up a series of things if he didn't think it was possible that Dr. O'Leary had actually done this. But he would have just said, no, I'm not going to be involved with this at all. So by entering into this agreement, he was showing a willingness to believe. It's just that as Dr. Rima said, for good scientists, it's really not a question of belief. It's a question of what you can prove to be true. And in this case, he was willing to believe, but only until proof could not be supplied.
And just for the sake of the transcript, did he put all of this into a letter, which he then sent to you?
Yes. Well, what happened was I was taking notes as he was talking, and so I, after our conversations, I asked him if he would be willing to put this into a letter, and he basically said, "Send your notes." And so I sent him my notes, and he wrote the letter, and the letter was submitted to the court.
Yes. Respondents Exhibit AA. Purposes. Now, switching gears a little bit, did you read the rebuttal opinions from Dr. Kennedy and Dr. Heppner concerning immunogenetics and PCR?
I did.
Now, Dr. Heppner goes into some detail about the work you did and suggests that CyberGreen is an inadequate tool for comparing results from TACMIN PCR testing. Do you agree?
No, not at all.
Why not?
Well, certainly in terms of the generation of amplicons, that really doesn't depend upon your detection system. You can detect PCR results with a wide range of reagents, with probes, as was pointed out last time, or with dyes that intercalate into the DNA. And so really, what is amplified in a PCR reaction is driven by the primers. And if the primers amplify something that is picked up either by a probe or by CyberGreen, it still is amplified by the primers. CyberGreen is actually a good first step to determining whether or not your primers are amplifying what you want. And so in this case, we chose to use the primers and CyberGreen, knowing full well that we were going to take any products that were amplified out to the stage of sequencing to know exactly what we were dealing with. And so we weren't going to rely on a probe to give us the specificity. We were actually going to take it all the way to the stage of sequencing. And so the detection system is irrelevant in terms of the major observation, which is that the O'Leary or the Ullman primers result in the amplification of things that in this case look like a duck, walk like a duck, but aren't ducks. They are human genes. So that in the multi-layered evaluation of the amplification products, we looked at melt curve analysis, we looked at the size of the amplicons produced, and then we did sequencing on the results. And some of the samples yielded things that had the correct melting temperature, had the right size on gel, but were nonetheless human gene products as opposed to viral gene products.
Now, on the topic of the primers, Dr. Heppner also suggested that the Southern blot and TACMAN PCR results ensure that the primers, like from Dr. O'Leary and Dr. Ullman, are basically doing what they're supposed to do, amplifying measles virus. You suggested it. Do you agree?
Well, I think that the Ullman primers on a positive control specimen can probably amplify the correct sequence. And it can be confirmed on a Western blot or a Southern blot, so that it's not the fact that the Ullman primers are so bad that they never amplify measles. It's just that they don't only amplify measles. That's really the distinction. They amplify measles. And so, yes, in this case, there's sort of no contest. They're both true. It's just that Dr. Heppner doesn't acknowledge that the primers amplify more than just measles.
And can this amplification problem affect data interpretation?
Well, of course, because if your primers are amplifying, are capable of amplifying both measles gene message or measles genes and human genes and human messages, then if you get a product, if you get a signal, you really don't know if it's the human gene that's been amplified or the measles gene that's been amplified.
Now, Dr. Rima testified about this at some length this morning, but because you also have expertise in PCR, I want to give you the opportunity to comment on this point of the rebuttals. With Dr. Kennedy and Heppner saying that high copy numbers eliminate concerns about contamination, assay inefficiency, and threshold cycle. Do you agree? Should you care to briefly comment?
Well, I think with the caveat that Dr. Rima has pointed out that, in fact, we have no idea what the actual copy number that was amplified was. All we know is the end product that's the result of a in some cases, huge multiplication. The fact that one has high copy number does not at all rule out that you have contamination. I could show you some students' work in my lab where they have extraordinarily high contamination and therefore have extraordinarily high rates of copy numbers. So simply to say we have high copy number, therefore it can't be contamination, doesn't make any sense at all. It can simply mean that you had gross contamination rather than low-level contamination. Although I have to say, low-level contamination is much more common, but gross contamination certainly can occur.
Now, Dr. Bradstreet, in his reports and his testimony on Monday, discussed a number of test results for Colton Snyder, implying that they would be indicative of measles virus persistence. I wanted to go through a few of them and just see to the extent they haven't been covered by our other experts. What's the significance of an elevated rheumatoid factor?
In isolation, almost nothing.
What sort of conditions can it be associated with?
A whole range of autoimmune, inflammatory, neoplastic, and infectious conditions. Many, many different conditions can give you an elevated rheumatoid factor.
And is
it's a fairly non-specific measure.
Now, does similar statement apply to anti-myelin basic protein titer?
Yeah, I would think so. In a single result in isolation or pulled from a very thick chart where hundreds of tests have been ordered, an isolated result needs to be interpreted in the light of the clinical presentation and all of the other results.
So would this also apply to the serum vitamin A and elevated IgE?
Absolutely. One of the axioms in clinical medicine, and Dr. Rima sort of deferred a little bit because he has experience with measles, but not so much clinical experience. But one of the axioms in clinical medicine is if somebody comes to you with a result, and I'll give you a result, an example in extremis. If a medical student comes to you with a result like a potassium value of 1, now they're going to come to you in a panic because that is not compatible with life. And you smile because you've been there before, and you say, did you stop and look at the patient? And the student says, well, yeah. Were they breathing? Yeah. The lab result is a mistake. It was probably drawn from the arm where somebody was running in an intravenous solution that has no potassium in it. And so, in isolation, any given value is almost, not completely, but almost useless. You also have to realize that all lab values are based on 95%, so normal ranges are based on 95% confidence intervals. That means that the normal range is determined by the population average value. By definition, that means that 2.5% of the values will be abnormally high or abnormally low. And so the statistical argument then becomes, if you do 100 tests on any of us in this courtroom right now, statistically, 5% of them will be abnormal. Half abnormally low, half abnormally high. And this would be if all of us in the room are completely healthy. What seems to have happened in some of these, with some of these lab results, is that Dr. Bradstreet would look at a very thick chart with lots of lab results and say, look at that one, that's abnormal. And then try to figure out a hypothesis that would explain that lab result in the context of the case that he was trying to build. I call it cherry-picking data. So one of the expert witnesses yesterday was asked about the high IgE. And, you know, the answer was, well, gosh, you really should pursue parasites. But that doesn't make a whole lot of sense unless there's a clear epidemiologic exposure to parasites. So if an individual comes from a developing world country, has high eosinophilias, high eosinophils, and high IgE, it would be completely logical to look for parasites. Even if they go to a daycare, if they're in daycare. We see kids like this all the time. Parasite and daycares are filthy places. If you see a child like that, you would logically look for parasites. But in isolation, without any other explanation, it just doesn't make sense to incorporate that into this larger theory based on a single report. What you should really do is say, well, is there a clinical picture that is logical, coherent, and explainable on the basis of known biology?
Parasite like pinworms?
Absolutely.
Now, I wanted to...
Eosinophilia and elevated IgE is very rare in pinworm infection. But certainly there are other parasites that are spread in daycares that can cause elevated IgE and eosinophilia.
I wanted to switch a little bit to Cole and Snyder and more like some specific MMR questions. Is the MMR vaccine known to cause an increase in secondary infections?
No. So far as I'm aware, there's never been any report of clinically relevant immune compromise in any way following vaccine.
And are the symptoms Colton presented with between his MMR vaccination and his May 26, 1998 hospitalization consistent with measles virus infection?
No, not that I can see.
Now, on direct examination on Monday, Dr. Bradstreet suggested that the small white patchy exudates, on April 6, 1999 might have been, or maybe actually that was probably May 6, 1999, I correct myself, might have been Koblik spots. Do you agree?
I don't. It, remind me how many days after the MMR that was. Is it day 14 or 14, 13? That seems to be very, very late. I've looked for a lot of Koblik spots because I've been involved in several outbreaks, including the one in Philadelphia in 1990. And Koblik spots are part of the prodrome of natural measles, so they occur very early at the time that the individuals, whether they be adults or children, have conjunctivitis, so red eyes, runny nose. Those individuals have no sore throat, but if you look carefully on the buccal mucosa, under just the right light, you have to be quite careful, occasionally you can see Koblik spots in the 2 to 3 days before the development of the rash. But it's a very subtle, very transient phenomenon, except in children who are severely malnourished. So I've seen them in the developing world as well. And then those Koblik spots can actually coalesce and result in sloughing of the buccal mucosa, sometimes with bleeding. But in reasonably nourished individuals, they are a very fleeting observation that you have to look hard. And the reason we spend so much time looking is that they are they're one of the very few things in medicine called pathognomonic, which is if you find it, you have the diagnosis. It's a guarantee. There's nothing else that causes Koblik spots. And so it's one of those things that older staff people like to do, because if you can find it, then you can show it to all of your students and say, look at this, this is pathognomonic of measles. It doesn't occur in vaccine strain disease.
Now, backing up to, again, the symptoms Colton had between, and I'm just going to use the window, April 23rd and May 26th, at the time he was hospitalized. Do you think they're consistent with measles encephalitis, ADEM, or PIEM?
I couldn't stretch there's no way that you can stretch the observations enough to make them fit, even reasonably, into any of those diagnostic criteria.
Are they consistent with any other condition known to be associated with measles virus?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Now, you mentioned in your first report that there was evidence that Colton Snyder had a bacterial infection at the time of his May 26, 1998 hospitalization.
Yes.
What are you relying upon to make that statement?
Well, the fact that he was sick, that he had an exudative pharyngitis, and that he had an elevated white count with a marked left shift.
What does that mean?
Most of the elevation of his white count was attributable to an elevation of his neutrophils, and so polymorphonucleocytes, and those are the classic white blood cells that respond to bacterial infections. He also had a very marked left shift, which is where the neutrophils, which are normally multi-segmented cells, the nucleus of a neutrophil typically has 4, 5, anywhere up to 12 lobes in its nucleus. But those lobes, like wrinkles on those of us who are passing 50, accumulate with age of the cell. And so a young neutrophil doesn't have very many lobes to its nucleus. And a white blood cell that's just released from the bone marrow is just, it often has no lobes, it's just a single big nucleus, just a band for a nucleus. And so those are actually called band neutrophils or bands. And in fact, he had a very elevated, what doctors call bandemia. He had an elevated level of neutrophils with this band form. And that's almost pathognomonic of an active ongoing bacterial infection. That's again one of those things that when you find it, you bring all of your students and trainees over and say, look at this, remember it, because it can really help you when you're trying to figure out if this is a viral or a bacterial process.
So is it fair to say that this was a laboratory finding that was consistent with the clinical picture?
Absolutely.
Is it consistent with a viral infection?
I would say almost impossible. I'm not aware of any viral infection that gives you an elevated band count. Furthermore, the relatively small number of lymphocytes, which are typically elevated in viral infections, when you have an active viral infection, many of those lymphocytes are what are called atypical lymphocytes. They are big, they are often angular. Most resting lymphocytes are little round things with dark nuclei and a very pale blue cytoplasm, using the typical stains. Atypical lymphocytes have a much larger nucleus, a more active-looking cytoplasm that tends to be a different shade of blue. And so competent technologists can readily say this is a typical and this is an atypical lymphocyte. And high lymphocyte count with lots of atypical lymphocytes would be standard for many acute viral illnesses. And at that time, Colton had relatively few lymphocytes with only, I think, 2 or 3% atypical lymphocytes. So very compatible with a bacterial process, not at all compatible with a viral process.
And is this left shift that you've just described evidence of a functioning immune system?
Oh, sure. It's the kind of response that you don't see in individuals who have just had a bone marrow transplant or who are immunocompromised because of chemotherapy. That's precisely the response that they can't make.
So overall, based on your own medical experience and practice, review of the medical records, expert reports, listening to the testimony in this case, do you place any reliance on the immunogenetics results for Colton Snyder?
No, I place no. I have no confidence whatsoever in the results.
Do you think there's any evidence to show that the MMR vaccine will probably then not cause Colton Snyder's ASD?
No, I do not.
Do you think the MMR part of this hypothesis is biologically plausible?
At some point in time, it may have been biologically plausible. Hypotheses have lives, and I think that this was a hypothesis that had someone as prominent as Michael Oldstone willing to consider it at one point. We embarked on our own study, in part because we were interested to know if there was any truth to this hypothesis. But it stops being credible after a certain point as evidence builds up against the hypothesis. There are many hypotheses that people consider to be too weird to be true. The one that comes to mind immediately is Stanley Prusner's insistence that prions existed. And he was roundly criticized for a number of years because nobody believed his data. His hypothesis at that point was just that. It was a hypothesis. But over time, he stuck with it. He convinced other competent scientists to work with him. And he demonstrated, in fact, that prions were an entirely new biology. And he, I think quite rightly, won the Nobel Prize, not only for his science, but for his stubbornness. I think in this case, so biologically plausible, yes, the hypothesis was biologically plausible at some point in some ways. But no longer, because the evidence that has accumulated in the time since the introduction of the hypothesis is just overwhelmingly against it. It was a hypothesis that was biologically plausible. It is no longer. It no longer deserves that recognition.
And you hold these opinions to a reasonable degree of medical certainty.
Absolutely.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Powers, do you want to recess or do you want to launch?
If we could just go ahead and do the recess, I don't think it will go long enough. We'll need to take another recess later, so we should do it now.
Well, it's 2:05 by my watch, so let's reconvene at 2:40.
Thank you.